Welcome to the podcast of Fellowship Church in Dallas, Pennsylvania. To find out more about Fellowship Church, visit fellowshipefc.org.
Well, welcome to the Fellowship Church podcast. This is Mark Ramirez. I'm the lead pastor of Fellowship Church, and I don't typically host our podcast. Chris and Jake do a great job with our podcast, but today, with all that's been happening in our world and also even locally and in our state with the COVID-19 crisis, I thought it would be good to have a conversation with a Christian doctor about this viral outbreak and get some perspective from somebody who has a medical background, but also has an understanding of the gospel and also a perspective of God with that. And so I have the privilege today of actually speaking with Dr. Michael Ramirez. He is a doctor in California, and he is also my nephew. And so it's extra special for me to be able to talk to him. And so, Michael, just want to welcome you to the podcast today.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
So he is, he's in California and just told me how beautiful it is. He's in a place where he can see the ocean and sun, and we can't here in Northeast PA. But I wanted, Michael, if we could, just to start with you introducing yourself, maybe just tell us a little bit about your role and the hospital that you're working in, if you could.
Yeah, so currently I live in a city called Ventura. It's about 45 minutes north of Los Angeles. I work at a level 2 trauma center, so it's a county hospital in Ventura. It's primarily for traumas, so any kind of accidents. And then it typically covers a lot of the uninsured patients or patients on Medicaid and Medicare. So it's an underserved population. We serve the entire county of Ventura, so our population is roughly 850,000 to like a million people that we see. And I trained here, and I work now in the ICU. So I'm a critical care physician. We have about maybe 16 to 20 bed ICU, and I'm one of the attendings now. So we have residency there, teach the residents, and I'm kind of the supervisor of that now, which is sweet. That's kind of good.
Okay, great. So my expectation would be, based on the fact that you are working in the ICU and having had been there and doing that kind of work, that you would have had interaction or at least certainly cases of dealing with COVID-19. And if you have, can you tell us a little bit about what that's been like?
Yeah. So right. Usually just to give an idea, when a patient comes to the emergency room, they're kind of triaged and decided whether they need to, one, come to the hospital, and then what level of care that the patient would need to be at once they're in the hospital. I primarily take care of patients that are the sickest, which means they need to usually be intubated, meaning there's a tube that helps them breathe and they're on a machine that's helping them breathe. This last week, it's been starting to ramp up the cases, kind of the pandemonium, the fear, the preparation of what may happen has been really ramping up, and I just worked last week. So what I've personally seen is I saw maybe 3 or 4 patients that were COVID-19 suspects or rule outs who were having really difficulty breathing. They couldn't maintain their oxygen levels on their own or even with a little bit of oxygen through their nose or with a mask, and so we needed to go forward and intubate. I took care of them throughout the hospital stay. And just to kind of give an idea, this COVID-19 is ultimately a virus. And so we see very similar symptoms or syndromes in other type of viruses or bacterial infections. So like influenza is very similar to this. And we manage it kind of accordingly. And so what I have done this last week is seen a few cases. The difference is it's very contagious, and so our entire preparation in the hospital is we're gowned up, and you may have seen pictures of, you know, other doctors with masks on and gloves and gowns and these big face masks. And so we're also in that kind of mode of safety just to prevent spread to other patients, to the healthcare workers and stuff like that. And that's been so far my experience this week.
Wow. So you said you have seen a ramp up, but it also sounds like what you're doing with the triage is trying to make sure that you're seeing, at least in the ICU, the most the patients who need the greatest care.
Exactly. And to kind of give, I think we can go into the different stages or the different symptoms of COVID-19 and
sure.
the spectrum of the illness. But primarily, I've been working with the most severely ill.
And are you seeing with that certain age groups, or is it kind of been what has been your experience with age groups?
Yeah, so actually, I'll give like a little background. So in terms of like epidemiology and highest risk groups, I'll start with kind of the coronavirus in general and what actually we think this whole thing is. So it's one, a virus. Coronavirus is a family, like an umbrella term of a specific type of virus. And interestingly, coronavirus is the common cold. So that's why it's spreading so rapidly, is because it's just the same family as a regular cold virus. The way viruses work is they're not living organisms. They're this capsule or this shell. And on the outside of the capsule are these little, kind of like keys or these little proteins that stick off the shell, and inside is the RNA or the DNA, the genome of that virus. What they do is they require a human living cell in order to replicate. So they'll bind to a cell in a human, they'll inject their RNA or their genome, and they can replicate using the proteins of the human cell that needs the human cell to do so. The interesting thing with coronavirus is that we're seeing a syndrome, or we're seeing these cases where, rather than it just being a runny nose and a cough, there is this pretty significant pneumonia or this kind of respiratory distress that's atypical of all colds. And what they found was that for some reason, this specific strain can bind to cells that have a high prevalence of this one receptor. You know, it's called ACE2, and that's high prevalence in the lungs. And so now you have a huge expression of this virus in the cells of the lungs, and then we're seeing this kind of syndrome that's been kind of unfolding. The strange thing is that other viruses in the past, and they can bind and have these bad symptoms, but they're usually not as contagious as this one is. So that's why this kind of pandemonium is kind of going on, because it's spreading rather rapidly. On average, if one person gets sick, about two people will get, a little over two people will also get the virus. So that's kind of the etiology, or like how it's working. The population that's most at risk, so when they look at all the studies so far, and it's kind of changing every day because it's so brand new, when they looked at the virus, there's no changes in the DNA, meaning it was very early on in human interaction. It hasn't changed much because it's so new. So in particularly in ages 0, like a baby, infant, until 10, almost no symptoms even. They don't even know they have it. The kids don't feel anything. It just runs through them, and they're just carriers, so they could spread the disease. But there's no actual symptoms. It's like less than a cold. Up to from 10 to 30, you know, there's a few cases where they may have some symptoms, like runny nose, sore throat, but really very, very few severe cases of even expressing a cough or pneumonia or fevers or chills, but very mild symptoms. It's once you get into the 40 to 60 age group where symptoms may become a little bit more severe and more pronounced, where you feel it. And that would be a fever, you have aches and pains, you may have a sore throat. And then very rarely would some of these patients in their 40s to 60s have the cough and the shortness of breath, where the virus starts to kind of express itself in the lungs. The the main cases that we've seen, and the cases that I have particularly seen, is mostly 65 plus at least one, and it's even more elderly. But the bigger risk, so one is 65 and older, and then there's significant risk with comorbidities or like pre-existing conditions, which would be congestive heart failure. So if your heart's not working well, if you have chronic lung disease from cigarettes or some other, you're inhaling a lot of things in the past and your lungs aren't working well, so you need medication to help. Diabetes, particularly if it's poorly controlled, and then any sort of autoimmune where your immune system's not working well, which would be you're on prednisone or a steroid or something to suppress the immune system, HIV, if you're on chemotherapy. Though that group of people are the ones that are most susceptible to having one, expression of the symptoms, and then two, to have actual critical care needs. Otherwise, it's very, very mild syndrome in the majority of the population. And so that's kind of the risk factors in the group that I particularly see is comorbidities and elderly are the primary two that I've seen in the ICU.
Okay, that's I again really appreciate you sharing that, because there's so much information going on and being talked about with this virus that sometimes you don't know, what to believe or what not to believe, and just kind of hearing how what you're saying is the different age groups are responding to exposure to the virus is really, I think, enlightening. For a lot of people, how would you personally, and again, we're talking to you, so we're looking for your personal, how you would personally advise somebody, but how would you personally advise somebody who you would consider to be in that high risk group? So right now there's a lot of restrictions happening, social restrictions happening right now, and the 6 feet and no groups of more than 10, and but just you personally, from what you've seen and what you know, how would you advise somebody who you would consider to be in that high-risk group, especially if someone is listening to this and they're in that group?
Yeah. Well, first, don't panic, or don't just kind of lose control and start to act based on fear. That would be the first thing. Just regardless of belief system or anything, just try to ultimately remain grounded. The virus primarily spreads, the way that we think, is called droplets, and which is the same as like the flu, which is if someone coughs, small little tiny droplets can go into the air, and then they either get in your eye or your mouth or your hands, and then you touch your mouth. And so that's the reason behind this 6 foot separation. Usually droplets won't travel beyond 6 feet unless, very rare cases of sneezing or something like that. But if you maintain that 6 foot distance, really the risk of transmission is very low. So that's the idea behind the social distancing thing. A lot of projections and studies have come out to show that if we all are kind of separating and isolating, the virus can't spread. It's like you're cutting its ability to survive and spread and kind of grow, because again, it's dependent upon human life in order to perpetuate. So that's the whole idea behind this movement now in shelter, and it's smart, and most of these projections show that it can, one, reduce the total number of cases, and two, reduce the rapidity or the exponential growth and spread of the virus, which is important because it will allow the resources of the hospital to maintain, to be sufficient. If the cases grow too quickly, it can outnumber and overwhelm the healthcare system, which we kind of see in Italy or like some small cases in New York. And so that's the idea behind maintaining distance, staying at home for the next 4 weeks. And the only other thing I'll say is, I think, and this is all projections and theory, but most likely we're looking, especially in areas outside of major cities, the rates may increase over the next 7 to 14 days and then hopefully peak and then come down. And so I think in the next 2 to 3 weeks, maintaining this in shelter, maintaining the social distancing will be really important for everybody of all age groups, so that the spread does not continue and not perpetuate, even in the younger population, because they're the ones that will be the carriers of the disease that may spread to these higher risk populations. So it's really important to kind of maintain this and kind of adhere to the recommendations. Now, in particular for the population who are at risk, I would just encourage that like tenfold. So stay home, try to avoid even going out to the grocery stores or anything. And just, if you can go totally if you have to, and just be smart. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, wipe down the, you know, everything that you can, and make sure you're washing your hands. And make sure that I think the biggest thing is make sure you're taking your medication. If you're a smoker, try not to smoke. Like don't go over the top with it. If you have diabetes, make sure your blood sugars are controlled. And then as a whole, I think general well-being is very important. So getting good sleep, eating healthy. I think our diet in America is not ideal. And when we eat poorly, your body responds to this food as external antigens or like an external protein, and it's trying to decide whether this is safe or not safe. So if you're constantly eating high antigenic foods that are pro-inflammatory, and you're eating out or you're having candy bars with all these like preservatives and things, your body's in a hyper-inflammatory state. And then when a real virus comes, it may not be in a place to kind of just battle the virus with all of its potential. So healthy diet, sleeping well, try to get a little exercise, walk outside, and take your medicine properly, and avoid avoid people in general. Try to stay at home as much as you can, and be smart and be safe.
Wow, that's I think that's really good, advice and really good counsel for people. And again, I really also appreciated the fact that you started by saying, you know, not to panic, not to go into a mode of panic or anxiety or worry, but because honestly, then you probably don't even make the best decisions to begin with. You know, just being calm helps you to make the right decisions to be more careful and more cautious.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think everyone has felt this, and I think we can get into it later even more in terms of spirituality or the spiritual battle of this entire thing. But fear across, really, which is interesting, across the globe, and maybe for one of the first times in honestly human history where the entire world is kind of connected on such a level of immediate communication, which has really been unprecedented in the past of all of human civilization. Now this fear that's rampant across all of humanity is spread so easily as the virus is spread, ironically. It's like it's an excellent analogy almost, in that the fear is just contagious itself. And if we respond to it inappropriately, or we let it just overtake us, we don't respond appropriately. We lose ability to have responsibility or control over our own decisions and decision-making. We're responding in this like defeated, fearful place. And that is something we should all keep out for, keep watch for, because that's a bad place to be. That's not, it's not going to be helpful.
I think that's a really helpful analogy to think about the fact that the spreading of fear could be as contagious as the virus itself, just because of how, like you said, this is not something that's just happening locally, it's happening worldwide, and so it's almost like we're all feeding off of each other's fear, and then the news reports and social media and the constant updates sometimes just feeds that fear instead of helping you ground, you know, be grounded, you know, have your faith strengthened. You just continue to react out of fear, and I think that's a good thing to think about, is that a good way to actually battle and be prepared to battle the virus is to not be responding to it out of fear, anxiety, and worry.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. There's an aspect of denial where if one is able to acknowledge the present moment, if one is able to like really just acknowledge and accept the fact that this is going on, it allows you to then not have to worry about denial or blame or fear. It allows you to have some sort of control and responsibility to say, like, okay, this is the situation that we're in. It's not as it's this is just where we're at. You can use your faith system to then move forward in that, but it gives you the ability to at least have choice and present moment, like awareness of this is where we're living, this is what I have to do and deal with. Now, how am I going to go forward in this? And I think trying to be present and not obsessed with a future state or a worry, which where you're only thinking about negative outcomes in the future, and allow yourself to come back to where we are right now so that you can have the ability to choose and act right now in this moment rather than being, you know, in this fantasy of future negative outcome. You know what I mean?
Right. And so much of what you worry about, it may not even come to be.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. You're adding things on top of what is actually a reality. So there are some things that are realities, but then you're bringing into it things that are not necessarily real. They're just possible. And if you exactly. play out everything that's possible, then you can almost never be in a place of peace.
Absolutely. You're paralyzed. You're stunned. And, you know, where can you even move? You're assuming that this is going to happen.
Have you seen patients coming in with that kind, so they maybe have symptoms or maybe they have been tested and they have the virus, and then you're actually trying to also medically manage the fear and anxiety as well as the actual virus itself?
You know, honestly, the patients that I've particularly seen I've been so sick that at that point it's almost like surrender. You know, they're on medications. We're sedating them, but it's funny. I think the people that are most prone to this fear based ideology or whatever it may be is the doctors. One, the hospital is very the doctors tend to get very fearful, which is good because we're trying to prepare and we're trying to get ready for what may come, which is an important aspect. But the doctors are one, and then healthy individuals who are not necessarily expressing symptoms, but you know they have a cough or they have a sore throat, and they're just and then it turns to panic, like, now I have this virus, now I'm going to get sick, I may die, and you just go down that path of worry. And I think that's where I've seen it the most. And trying to, even around my friends and people my age, trying to give them, one, information about the virus so that they have accurate information. And then, two, to remind them that, you know, this is all future ideas and stuff like that, trying to get them back to, you know, we're here, you're okay, I'm watching you, like, you let me know how you're feeling and moving forward that way.
Yeah, that's, and again, that's just a little bit more of a practical way as opposed to just,
exactly.
you know, responding to it out of fear. I'm going to go back to something you mentioned earlier, and we're going to, in a little bit, I want to also explore more just about how your faith in Christ impacts even how you're medically approaching this. But going back to the person who right now maybe listening to this and maybe they're displaying some general symptoms of what you would maybe consider to be the, because you mentioned several with the common cold or even the flu, but how they parallel so well with the symptoms of COVID-19. So a person right now is dealing with that and they're probably thinking, I need to call the doctor, I need to get tested, I need to go to the ER, just because of the heightened awareness and what's happening. How would you, as a doctor, this was your patient, somebody just generally showing general flu symptoms, how would you kind of advise them to, you know, the progress or the steps maybe to take?
Yeah. So firstly, I'd speak specifically to each kind of risk group. So if you're a patient who is above the age of 65, who does have multiple comorbidities, and you're just higher risk in general, if you're having symptoms of fever, ache, pains, and kind of viral symptoms, and you begin to have any sort of cough, shortness of breath, any symptoms of that nature, it would be important to see a physician, get tested. I think now, and it kind of varies from state to state and county to county, infrastructure in terms of testing, but in general, I think we're right now, it doesn't seem to be too overloaded in specific areas. Inner cities does seem like there's a little bit more difficulty, but you should be able to go to an urgent care and get a drive-by test, and or go to the emergency room and see, you know, get tested, see if your oxygen levels are okay. So at higher risk groups, if you are having symptoms of fever and cough and you're feeling short of breath and you're actually working to breathe, that would be a reason to actually go and particularly the emergency room. If you're not in that group and you're younger, healthier, you don't have all these comorbidities and you're feeling some mild symptoms, keep an eye on it, distance yourself. That would be the first thing, is do not expose yourself to other people for the sake of preventing you from spreading it. And use kind of common cold remedies. So try zinc. Zinc is a great medication in terms of common cold that can sometimes reduce the length of colds. Vitamin C, you know, maybe it has some efficacy. Honey has been shown to reduce cold, so tea and honey, and then drink a ton of water and sleep as much as you can, and all of those things may improve that. As soon as you have, if you're having real symptoms of fever and shortness of breath in any age group, it's reasonable to get tested. And I would say, though, if they're very mild symptoms, the emergency room, especially in the coming weeks, if this does turn into kind of a bigger prevalence and more patients are having it and the emergency room is filled, that's, if you don't have the virus, you're going to expose yourself to it in the emergency room. So I would try to encourage only the highest risk, you know, if you're really having symptoms, to go there. Otherwise, try to use these drive-by clinics or these urgent cares where you're a little bit more removed from the inner, you know, emergency room department where the sickest people may be, because that's where, if you don't have it and you just have a regular cold, you put yourself at risk of getting it. So not to discourage people from going there, but if they really need to, but simultaneously, you know, be wise in where you go and to what extent you're hypervigilant almost, particularly in the lower risk groups.
You're on that subject of what you just said about the ER, it's possible that someone could go in with COVID-19 symptoms to the ER, be treated, actually, they're not going to find out their test result right then anyway, right, Michael?
Exactly. Right now, at least our hospital is taking about 24 hours. So that's why those tests, like, if you're not having symptoms, if you're really not having shortness of breath and, you know, you're doing okay, but you're maybe having some mild symptoms, and a drive-by at urgent care where you're not exposing yourself, you're not getting, you know, you'll get the test results and now you'll know. The majority of those cases, regardless, are going to improve without the need of this critical care management, needing to get hospitalized, if it's a low-risk population. So I think that would be the best place to get tested if you're having those symptoms. And then if you're not having real fevers, if you're not having real cough and real shortness of breath, and you're really not, and you're feeling, or these real malaise where you're having terrible aches and pains, if you're not having those symptoms, I would try to just treat it and manage it conservatively at home at first and see, you know, as it progresses and see how you feel. Different though in those higher risk populations, like I mentioned.
Yeah, because it's possible that most likely you're going to get sent home anyway to manage the symptoms, unless, exactly, like you said, unless it's so severe that you're going to be hospitalized. But exactly, in most cases, most of the people who are showing symptoms of general flu symptoms or general cold symptoms, they are not going to be admitted. And so where possible, it's probably best to try to treat those symptoms as best they can at home. And then obviously, if you get to a more severe level, then obviously you go to a doctor or you go to the ER.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, no, that's really good. Again, appreciate you sharing that and just having, again, not even just opinion, but also just experience, because this is something that you're dealing with right now in the hospital that you're working at. We talked a little bit about the social restrictions, and I think you explained that really well about why it's important and why we need to continue, especially in this next, I guess, few weeks of time, to allow the number to plateau, I guess is what they're saying. I think that's also important for people to hear. I wanted to just ask you something personally, as a medical doctor and somebody who's dealing with this every day in the hospital, but also you have the knowledge of understanding exactly how this works and what's happening. How do you feel about what you're hearing just generally, or even seeing on social media or through the news or whatever the different mediums of communication are, when you have an understanding of what's really happening and what's like, but then you're hearing so many different variations of that. How do you kind of process through that? Because you must be hearing misinformation as along with the correct information.
Yeah, you know, it's so difficult. I don't want to get too far into like speculation or something, you know, but it's very strange. And firstly, if you turn on the news, the only thing on is coronavirus. So the only thing that's going to sell, or the only thing that's going to be the top, you know, hit or the top click or whatever it's going to make people watch, is going to be these rare cases where it is a 36-year-old male who was previously healthy and now he's in the ICU and he's really sick. And so they're showing that one case and now everyone's like, oh, well, now all 30-year-olds are getting coronavirus. They're able to get this and have, you know, these critical illnesses. And so you're getting these like anecdotal single cases that are extremely rare, and they're expressed on the news or on the media for bigger stories or whatever it may be. And then it leads to further spread of fear, but it's the thing that kind of sells. And so I think, you know, it's difficult because you need to have the information, and it's important to have, you know, daily kind of updates and statistics and things like that. But I would just encourage people to really, there are a few websites I could actually give you some websites that I use to look at. It has all the rates of mortality rates or risk factors and like up to date, almost hourly. And I can give that to you. Maybe you can post it.
Okay.
So that people and listeners can have something to really look into and have more information in terms of what I'm talking about, because it can go on for hours. But you can look through this website and kind of see a better idea of who is actually the ones that are in the hospital and sick, which population really is. And you can see the statistics kind of up to date. And so I would just encourage that and keep a mindfulness in terms of what is the motivation behind a lot of this news media. And it may not be well-being or calmness or peace amongst the population. It's trying to sell and get more things. And I think that's an aspect of, you know, I mean, the only thing that's on the news in general, and this is just one big one, is bad things that happen all the time. So
right.
I just, you know, try not to get too attached to these rare cases and then, you know, identify as that I'm in this population, I'm going to get this, I'm going to go down that path of fear and fantasy and expect the worst, you know.
So somebody, it's a really good example that you just gave there of the 36-year-old, you know, the anecdotal story. And there's one of those for every age group, or one of those for every, you know, maybe, you know, segment of the population.
Exactly.
How do you then, as a doctor and someone who understands this medically, so here's somebody who listens to a story like that, and then they translate it into, this means that all 30-something-year-olds were all susceptible. But you, as a doctor, knowing the information, how do you process that same case? How do you understand it when you just see and you find out about, okay, yeah, there is a case of a 35-year-old or a 36-year-old, and maybe that will help people understand it better? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, it's such a good question because, yeah, I'm still, you know, I'm still exposed to all of this, and so I'm still relatively young, and I still have to deal with these, you know, my own person. I'm a human going through the same thing, right? So I'm going to deal with the same fear. And so I think, and I know we're going to get into it, but I think that's where faith and my upbringing and what I have in my heart with the Lord has helped me through this, because I was dealing with it. And then I'm exposed to it like every day. And so I'm just like, oh man, if I go, I have to intubate this patient now, I'm going to expose myself, blah, blah, blah. And there's that one case. But one, if we're just talking practically, the statistics would be exceptionally unlikely for me to be that other 31-year-old male who gets intubated and has to go to the hospital. So logically speaking, it'd be like winning the lottery to an extent, or, you know, just a bad lottery.
Right.
And so it's unlikely. It's just kind of irrational. It's irrational in terms of logic. And all I can, and regardless, it comes back to this present moment and like, what can I do then right now in order to prevent this, or to at least set myself up practically to prevent these things from moving forward? And I'll stay home. I'll really wash my hands this time. Like, I won't start eating or do anything. I'll just be really mindful as best as I can. I may not be perfect. And just trying to adhere to the things. And simultaneously not be filled with such anxiety and depression, because that puts me in a place where I'm not even prepared to kind of heal myself and like allow my body to heal if the virus comes and work through that, so that I can try to be in a place of health. So I exercise every morning, or I've really been focusing on sleeping and doing those things like I mentioned, and just really trying to adhere to them myself practically, so that I could set my body physically up for to prevent those weird cases.
Wow, I think that's really good to hear, because that was one of the next questions I was going to ask, is kind of how you are going about protecting yourself. In other words, you're taking the right precautions, the things you're just talking about now, eating the right way, exercise, having the right equipment, and you know, wearing gloves, you know, all the different things that you need to be doing. But then it also sounds like you're protecting yourself not just from the physical virus, but you're doing things that are more healthy for your soul. You're talking about spiritual things, or just even having the right mindset and the right approach going in there. Because if you went in there every day with fear that I'm going to be dealing with a patient, I got to intubate a patient right now who might give it to me, if that's how you're operating in your current in your role, that would make you ineffective, and then also it would probably put you at more risk, wouldn't you think?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I know, and personally, in studying, like, so as a doctor, like I've studied very much of the physical body, but in addition to that, I really believe that an individual is much more than just like the physical body. And in addition to that, the physical body is kind of, I am more than just my body. I have my mind, like my mental component. I have my emotional aspect, which is more of like the soul or my essence, and then like the spiritual component. And if you consider each of them, if you use like an analogy of a car or an engine, if each of them were pistons in a car and you were firing only on one cylinder, it would just be not as effective as it could be. So if you can be in a mental state, in an emotional state, in a spiritual state, in a place as healthy in each of those places, then your entire being is in a state of wellness. And I think that's where it extends beyond matter or like physical scientific fact, that because once you get into psychology or spirituality or like emotional soul states, you know, it's not tangible, it's not something you can observe, and yet there's aspects that we all know and we can see and how they affect one another. And there is this aspect where clearly if my mental or emotional state is in bad places, my physical body experiences that bad emotional state very strongly, whether it's stomach pain, or you have chest pain all the time, or you're having migraines and headaches, or you're getting sick all the time because you're just never, you're so unwell in these other realms of my being. And so I think that aspect of maintaining as an individual, firing on all of those cylinders, you know, and me being mindful of that, I personally am trying to maintain health in each of those realms or each of those spheres of being that I believe in. And I think that definitely has an aspect of well-being physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good lead-in into just you yourself as a Christian doctor, as a doctor who has himself trusted in Christ and understands exactly, you know, what it is that Christ has done for us. And so now you've got a faith that impacts what you believe about not only life, but what happens in the afterlife. And you've got this scientific and medical knowledge, but at the same time, you also are believing very firmly, like I just said, in this spiritual aspect of trying to honor and please the Lord is important to me, as a doctor, and in my profession. And so I just kind of wanted to ask you about that personally. Like, how does your faith in Christ impact even how you're processing what you're seeing every day, how you're dealing with what you're seeing and in the ICU and sick patients and this COVID-19 outbreak. So you're a doctor, so you have a medical side, but then as a Christian and a person who believes in Jesus and has trusted in him, there's also this part. So just wanted to delve into that a little bit.
Yeah, it's good. So even a few weeks ago when this all started, I was experiencing great fear. I don't even know. I was just experiencing fear. And ultimately, it was this strange fear. It intends to be like this entire pandemic, the news, all this stuff. The source of the fear, or the power of the fear, is ultimately death. And I really experienced it heavily in various ways. I couldn't understand why I'd have like, and I know other people feel this, but like you're all of a sudden you have like, was my lymph node swollen or something, or something's off, maybe, I don't know. And then I just go down that crazy path, and it starts maybe physically, and then it kind of transcends upward into like that emotional state of just panic and fear and irrational, or just like disproportionate emotional response to this vague symptom of whatever I may be having. But it's rooted ultimately in this fear, and I was really experiencing that personally. So, you know, I think up to this point, we've been talking practically and logically about everything as best we can, which is important. But then there gets to the point where, you know, there's a limitation there. And fortunately, like, honestly, by the grace of God, and ultimately in his word, peace came to me, and it has helped me in these last few weeks to, one, be able to continue to work in the hospital and not be afraid and not get kind of prone to everyone else's fear around me, to kind of delve into that fear, accept that and take it on as my own, and not identify as that fear in myself or respond to that fear in my heart. So and I know, and the one psalm that got me, and I don't, the Lord just kind of, I don't know, it just, you know, when things just come about, was Psalm 91. And I know that's kind of classic in terms of protection, but I read it, and it's like how he says, for those who have eyes to see or ears to hear, for the first time reading, I've read it so many times, and there's aspects where it hit me, or I it was reassuring, but this part, in the face of this death or this fear, hearing it was such a relief. And like and beyond relief, but a confidence and a protection that it gave me such a peace, in that I was almost ready to then move forward into the fear further because of this protection that it had. So I was like, this is my job, and I have to move forward in it physically, but then it's also like the spiritual aspect of moving forward through it as well. And the word gives, because it is the word, it gives me the ability to take it confidently and then use it as like the sword of the spirit to fight through spiritually in my own heart, or in my own process, in my own journey. But particularly, you know, I have it up here just so I have it to reference, but the beginning, just the first verse, it says, whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. So whoever is dwelling there, if I am dwelling there, and I think, and an aspect of that is the choice. It's always open. It is always there for me to dwell in his shelter. And yet, without faith, I can't be there. It is impossible to please God. You know, whoever comes to him or dwells in him, one, I must believe he exists and that he rewards me for earnestly seeking him, or those who earnestly seek him. And so that reward, though, is kind of the rest of Psalm 91, and how he says, though 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, it will not come near you. You'll observe with your eyes and see what may happen to the wicked here. You don't have to fear the pestilence that stalks in the night, you know, or in the darkness. All of those things began to actually manifest themselves personally here, like in the present moment, which was such an overwhelming feeling, because it gave me the confidence and the courage to kind of move forward, you know, in the physical world, and yet also spiritually, and sequela some of that fear in my heart. And I just was really trying to pray that over and over in my heart so that it was written in there. And it gave me such a peace that it made me tear up. It was such a relief. And I think that was the beginning of protection, this spiritual and physical protection that I was able to hold on to because it was the Word and because it was written for believers and those who dwell with Him.
Yeah, that's that's beautiful. I appreciate you sharing that. And it's so true that Scripture becomes such a way for us to find this peace and this rest that we're looking for in the midst of trying, turbulent times. And I've been talking a lot about this to the church, that we are clearly in unprecedented times. I mean, this is just unprecedented. There is no handbook of how to, even pastorally respond and deal with this. But when you're dealing with something that's never really been happening before, unprecedented, it is then that you need something that is not changing, that is not shifting sand, and that's what God has provided us through His Word. And to hear you talk about how, a psalm that is many of us know, and maybe written on, different things as a reminder, it's become so meaningful and alive to you, because every day you've got to walk into that ICU to do your job, knowing that you're putting yourself at risk. But ultimately, what you're saying, what I hear you saying, is ultimately you're putting your faith in God, and He's the one who's going to go before you, and He's the one that you're trusting in each and every moment that you're there.
Yeah, and it's such a good feel. It's such a relief, because then, yes, like, I have a role, and I'm not going to go shake hands with all these people, or I'm going to wear a mask at the hospital, but it's almost irrelevant at this point. It's kind of like when, I think Jesus walked in that so much, because He put Himself in insane positions, and people were picking up stones to throw at Him, or He'd be in big mobs that were about to kill Him, and He knew that it wasn't His time. He knew that He was protected. He said, like, I can have angels come, thousands of angels come and take care of me and do everything that needs to be done, but that's not, that wasn't part of His plan. But up to the point of His death, He knew without a doubt that God was that He was dwelling in the shelter of the Most High, that He was watching over Him, right, and protecting Him completely. And so it's a relief. It was a relief to me in that, to have the faith, which is so scary even to talk about now, is to have the faith, though, that, yeah, the Lord is watching over me. And my time may come, and we're in a battle, and it's a spiritual battle as much as it is physical, yet He's watching over me, and in His timing it may be, but not now. Like, I do not need to fear. The fear is, I think, what gets me oftentimes, that overwhelms me, is this fear of punishment. I forget the verse. I know you probably know it. There is no fear in love, because your fear is rooted in punishment, and punishment is ultimately this death that I deserve because I'm not doing enough, or I haven't proven myself enough, or maybe if I had done this, or I was foolish and I deserve this punishment, I deserve to get this virus or whatever. Going down that rabbit hole is one, a lie, is confusion, because it's just pure confusion and chaos, and it's not the Word. It's not the Word of God, and I tend to go down that route. And yet when I come back and see that He is there and He is for us, then there's nothing to fear. It's just love, and I can move forward in that with confidence and strength and all of that.
Yeah, and I think another aspect that we have to continue to remember is that our trust in God and our faith in God cannot be circumstantial. And I think what we see around us right now is it's a major happening. It's a major circumstance that is external. It's all around us. But what God is asking us to do, and I think has asked all of the people in Scripture, I mean, you can look at David's life. You can look at Daniel's life. There's so many different examples. We have Paul's life in the New Testament, where the outside circumstances looked terrible, but their instruction was to remain trusting God, have faith in God, that God can be trusted, that God is good through this. And so it's not circumstantial. And I think, you know, that I think that's what allows even a believer, a Christian who did all the right things to prevent COVID-19 and ends up getting it and is sick and is laying in their bed, that they can still trust God through that. Because again, their faith in God isn't circumstantial. It isn't, well, only if God keeps me healthy and does everything according to the way I want him to, then I'll trust him. Because that's not really what he's calling us to do in faith. That's us kind of determining what the faith looks like, as long as God works it according to our plan. But he's asking us to trust him with his plan for our life, and that he has good things in mind. And even when they don't go the way we think they should, he is still God and still can be trusted.
I'm so glad you brought it up, because that was something, because it says in Psalm 91, like, you'll see the punishment of the wicked. And then I was like, well, if I got COVID-19, then am I the wicked that's deserving this punishment? And I, as a believer, you can't go, that's viewing the word inappropriately. And it's just, as you said, it's not circumstantial, and that's not the way to view it. And I think as I've been going through the hospital, I see a lot of patients who do need to pass away, and I have to talk with the family, and we have to take the tube out, and we have to turn to like comfort measures and things, and it's difficult. It's more than difficult to view the grief that each of these people have, and then it's difficult for me then to walk through that and not kind of project it onto my own life or the people that I love, and have to, you know, see what would I be in the situation, how would I respond to this. And one of the verses that really helped me was in 1 Thessalonians 4, where Paul kind of continues to talk about how, one, I think what's so cool in that chapter is he really doesn't say death or dying. He constantly says who are asleep in death, who have fallen asleep, and we do not need to grieve like those who do not believe, because they're just asleep, and Jesus will come back. They will rise from the dirt. They'll rise from Sheol or from the grave, and with their bodies physically, they're not dead. They're just asleep now. Their battle is done. Their race is run. Now this isn't a punishment. This is just the course of the life here on earth, and we have the hope and in faith that God is love, and that they will be awakened again, and we'll all be together and reunited, and there is no reason to grieve. And with that, again, is the word is allowing us, or allows me, to have the confidence that I don't need to fear this punishment or this idea of that if I got the virus or anything, that it's because I've done something wrong or God doesn't love me. It's the opposite, and that is just that is our time. And we don't have to grieve now. We continue to move forward as believers and continue to walk the path. It's very difficult because we're stuck in like a linear time. We're in like three-dimensional creatures, right? And we're stuck in linear time. And so when someone passes away or falls asleep, we see it as death, but yet they're not dead. You know, they are not experiencing it as death. They are asleep and will come again with the Lord. And so it's just, I think, the last thing I'll say, I don't mean to ramble, is this whole process, all of these things, like you mentioned, Daniel or David, when a great evil confronts them, or a great fear confronts them, grace, their faith in God, allows them to rise above it somehow. Like, grace overcomes that and gives them the opportunity to then be these huge symbols and like almost mythological figures in the Bible to give us hope that when these things and when this time arises, do not fear, because it's going to be like, it's going to be bread for you. It's going to be the fuel or like the lead that can get turned into gold and that can be transmuted, or that will, it's this fear and this panic or this adversity, the resistance is necessary so that the power of God can be seen, and to not revolt back in fear, but push through into faith and into ultimately love, and just, you know, move forward in that.
Yeah, that I appreciate you talking about the fact that in your current role, you're often faced with our humanity's mortality and having to have those conversations with families And seeing that, you're seeing that often, and I'm sure it's not easy. And being a pastor and being involved in funerals on a regular basis also reminds me of the same mortality. And then with that comes just this, you're just like, you, exactly what you just said is exactly the same thing I do also. I'll be thinking about, well, you know, what if this was this person, or what happens when it happens here, and how am I gonna, it's always this constant reminder that this is, that we are mortal, and that that a time like this is coming, and it makes us think about, well, what is to come after this? And then that's what brings us to Christ, and the fact that the whole reason that Paul could give the encouragement he gave in 1 Thessalonians 4 is because Jesus, because of the fact that Jesus Christ is alive and is right now seated at the right hand of the Father, that is the certainty he had to tell those Christians in Thessalonica that, don't worry, you are going to see these people again. We're going to see them again. And it's all based, and it's all rooted and grounded in the resurrection of Christ on our behalf. And that's what allows Christians and people who believe in Jesus in this way to get through, like you said, to get through these difficult, evil, even fearful moments. And the scripture's full of examples of those. So, Michael, I wanted to, we're quickly here running out of time, and I just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, and to be on our podcast, and to share this information with our church and with those who listen and in our community. And my hope is that this won't be the last time that we're able to have you on, and maybe there'll be another opportunity in the future on maybe a little bit of a different kind of subject. But I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and to share your knowledge and your insight with us. And I hope that those who have been listening will also just be praying for you as you continue to put yourself in harm's way, but doing so again because you're there to serve people and to help them, and to use the gifts that God has given you to do that, and then of course ultimately serving the Lord. So thank you very much. I want to give you the opportunity to have to say whatever else it is you wanted to say as your kind of last words with the podcast. So anything else you wanted to share?
No, I just wanted to also just say thank you for having me. It's very cool. I it's an honor, and I hope that I know we talked a lot about, you know, practical stuff, and I hope it doesn't bring fear to anybody, but it just gives them information so that they know how to respond appropriately, and then to use, you know, just remember to use your faith and know that God is good, and that he is just good, and that he is full of love, and that we can move forward together. We need to stay together and remind each other and have grace with each other. And I hope I would say is to believers, anyone listening, and to myself, is that in these times of trouble, whenever that has happened in the past with the church, it has only led to further advancement of the gospel. It has led to a bigger audience. It's now, people are now getting forced to kind of deal with this, with death and fear and all these things. And what it does is it opens their hearts to the reality of the love that God has to offer. And so I think in this time, if we can stand and be strong as individuals in God and in the Word, then we may have the opportunity to then share his word as servants of him to bring more into the kingdom as his time nears. And so don't fear. And I'll be praying for you guys in your church and everyone as well. So it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. And I want to thank all of you who've been a part of the podcast and for listening. We appreciate you taking the time. And as Michael shared, we do hope that this has been encouraging to you. The point of sharing this information was certainly not to generate a fear, but in knowledge and understanding to understand what's really happening, and then also ultimately to put your hope and your trust in God. And so we thank you again for joining us on the Fellowship Church podcast. Mm-hmm.